Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and this is Internet Talk Radio, recorded from the west coast of Sweden in Scandinavia. We are here with a new program every Thursday and Sunday, but you can, of course, tune into a radio show anytime online. All information on how you can access our free radio archive or sign up to access our subscriber section is available on our website, redicecreations.com. And I'm glad that you are here today. We have an interesting guest with us on the line. Researcher, author, and lecturer Lloyd Pye is with us. And today we are going to talk about Lloyd's fascinating research into the Star Child, the Star Child skull, intervention theory, human origins, and much, much more. I also want to mention that Lloyd is the author to Everything You Know Is Wrong, Origins of Life and Humans. And his latest book is called The Star Child Skull, Genetic Enigma or Alien or Human Alien Hybrid. The websites that you should take a look at right away is lloydpye.com, and that is Lloyd Pye spelled LloydPye.com, lloydpye.com. And there's also starchildproject.com, and there's tons of information up there for you to look at. Articles, photos, slideshows, and audio presentations on everything from human origins to megaliths, hominoids, and of course the Star Child skull. And I'm looking forward to dive into these very fascinating subjects here today. So let's say welcome to Lloyd Pye to the program. Thank you so much for joining us, Lloyd.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on programs from other countries to bring the material and the information that I have to those places that don't necessarily often get to be exposed to it. And I think certainly the Star Child is one of the most important things in the world today. Not that many people know about it yet, but we're certainly busy trying to get the word out, and this is a wonderful venue for doing that in Sweden.
Absolutely. I totally agree. That's what we're trying to do here, highlight information that aren't, that much highlighted in the mainstream, as it were. And, of course, the Internet gives us that wonderful opportunity to dive into these subjects more and more. And there's so many topics here to address today. Of course, the Star Child skull and the Star Child project, human origins itself, and the what you refer to as the intervention theory. And I guess it all kind of ties together on one level. But let's start at the beginning, Lloyd. There, if you will, tell us how you got on this track to begin with. That's always fascinating to hear.
Well, I'm 60 years old now, and so it goes back to 1968, actually, when I was a senior in college. And, you know, you just go into the library one day and you're looking around and you see a book and you pull it out and you start reading and your life is changing and you don't really realize it. The book that I happened to pull out and look at was called Abominable Snowmen, Legend Come to Life by a man named Ivan Sanderson, who had written it about, at that point, 7 or 8 years earlier, and I didn't know about it. I didn't know it was there. So to me, it was a, quote, old book. And it was about the reality of hominoids around the world, hominoids being Bigfoot, Sasquatch, the abominable snowman, and other types of those creatures that exist in all parts of the world, and including Sweden, I would assume. But anyway, I don't really follow Swedish reports of hominoids, but it if you have a lot of heavily forested land, which I assume you do, then it's possible that you would have them living there. But certainly, they live in the more temperate areas around the world, every continent except Antarctica. Now, people say, well, why don't we know about them? Well, if you read the evidence that's available, they are seen on a regular basis. Every year you have around the world about 150 what are considered quality sightings, where it's hard to dismiss. You see actually more quality sightings of hominoids than you do of UFOs. So they're there. And the footprints that they leave are manifest. They're real. They are not made by ghosts. They are made by creatures that are just simply not human beings. They're upright walking, hair-covered, primate-type creatures, but they're not human beings. And so when I first read that book and began to understand how widespread they were, that it wasn't just this isolated kind of freak show thing going on in America's Pacific Northwest, which at the time was all I knew about, what Ivan Sanderson showed me very clearly, and others as well, that it was a worldwide phenomenon, and that these things were legitimate and real and worthy of study because the evidence was so overwhelming in so many places. So I just got interested, and I began to read then more and more whatever I could find. There wasn't an awful lot, but this kind of information, and I'm sure you're aware of it by now, doing the work that you're doing, this isn't forbidden information. This is just hidden information. It isn't put out there widely by the mainstream. You have to make an effort to go find it. It's there. You can access it, but nobody's going to put it in front of you. You're not going to see it on mainstream media.
That's right.
Because they have a prohibition against it. So you just find it as best you can. So it generally takes a long time to develop a real thorough base of knowledge about it. So it took me a number of years to fill my head with enough information about hominoids to where I felt like I knew something, worthwhile about it. But by the time I was 30, I was just convinced, utterly convinced, that hominoids were the native, indigenous, upright, walking primate creatures of planet Earth, and that human beings did not evolve here. We couldn't have, according to the way I read the fossil record, because if you look at the fossil record, all the creatures that we are told we descend from in a direct line of descent by Darwinian evolution, if you look at those creatures, starting with the Australopithecines, the ones like Lucy, for example, which everybody knows about and which is in the news today because they've found, the next one would be Homo habilis, and then Homo erectus, and then Neanderthals, and then Cro-Magnons, which were basically humans. In that progression from Australopithecines to Homo habilis to Homo erectus to Neanderthal, up through Neanderthal, they don't look human at all. They just don't look human at all in the face. They have a completely different cranial structure than we have. All of them have no foreheads, large round night vision type eyes, sockets, big wide splayed noses, mouths that stick off their face in the prognathous fashion, and no chin. That's all of them. All of them from Australopithecines to Homo habilis to Homo erectus. So you're talking about 4 million years. 4 million years of evolution produces these creatures who all look the same. They just get bigger. And they have variations that allow people to say, well, this is a different species, but still they are maintaining those fundamental cranial characteristics, all of them. And then suddenly, boom, at around 120,000 years ago in the fossil record, 120,000 years ago in the fossil record, you have this sudden appearance of a new creature, Cro-Magnon, that looks like humans. Now you have a forehead where you didn't before. You have greatly reduced eye sockets, no longer night vision type eyes. You have a much tighter nose pushed off the face than those splayed wide ones that they had before. You have a mouth that is no longer sticking off the face in the prognathous fashion. It's pushed back into the face. And you have a chin where you had no chin before. These are major, major, major anatomical changes, and they all come at once in a complete reconfiguration. It isn't any kind of a gradual reshaping. It's just a wholesale reconfiguration overnight. And science understands this. Science recognizes this, that they have a real problem. So what they do is they say, well, there's a missing link out there. Mm-hmm. We're going to find the missing link someday. And they've been looking for it forever, and they're going to look for it forever because there is no missing link. There was no gradual development from those creatures into us. We appear overnight in the fossil record, period. So, human beings do. So what I began to understand was that what we were looking at with the skeletons, the fossils of the so-called pre-humans, were in fact nothing but the skeletons of the fossils of hominoids, the upright walking, hair-covered primates that are still walking in the world today. Now, then you say to yourself, well, okay, maybe, where did they come from? Where do those creatures come from? Is there any sign of them in the deep past, or do they too just simply appear out of nowhere? Well, they don't, actually. As it turns out, there are a group of creatures that are well known, just, again, not well talked about, but you can Google them, you can look them up, it's no problem. They're called Miocene apes. And the Miocene period goes from about 25 million years ago to about 5 million years ago. That's the period of the Miocene. And in those 20 million years, they are dominated in the fossil record by apes, not monkeys, apes, fossilized apes. And these are tailless creatures, tailless apes, not monkeys. So you've got about 50 right now categorized, about 50 different species. Now, admittedly, these are not, you know, I wouldn't go to the bank on that many, but each guy that discovers a Miocene ape or parts of Miocene apes, and you only really get them in parts, they try, of course, to name a new species after their find. So they're not inclined to do a lot of clumping. But I would imagine there could be as many as 10 or 12 legitimately different ones out of those 20 million years. And you have a real interesting phenomena in the Miocene apes, which keeps them from being talked about very much by the scientists who study them. They don't talk to ordinary people about this problem, which is you have short-armed Miocene apes and you have long-armed Miocene apes.
Okay.
A clear distinction between the two kinds. Now, the short-armed Miocene apes have arms that are approximately the length of their legs. The long-armed Miocene apes have arms that are clearly longer than their legs. Now, what is that distinction? That distinction is this. If you have arms longer than your legs, you are a quadruped. You are down on all fours because you can't walk comfortably on all fours if your legs are equal to the length of your arms. Your arms have to be stronger and longer. Well, not necessarily stronger, but they have to be longer for sure to be able to allow you to locomote on the ground comfortably. Short-armed apes, on the other hand, had arms the length of their legs, and so, guess what? They couldn't locomote comfortably on all fours. Science has a problem with them to explain how they would locomote comfortably on ground. You know how they say they did it?
No.
They say they were knuckle draggers, that they were squatted down like in a half squat position, lumbering along, walking with their hands or knuckles dragging on the ground. Not walking like a normal quadruped, just squatting down like we had an exercise when we were boys, and I'm sure you had the same thing, called a duck walk, where you have to squat down, you know, with your knees bent a lot and your thighs sort of parallel with the ground, and you were basically doing a knuckle walk there. Now, that's hard. You do that just a little bit, and that hurts. Your thighs start to burn.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel good. I would think if I was a knuckle-dragging ape, I would look around and I'd say, wait a minute, Martha, what if I stand up here just a little bit? I think it'd feel a lot better. And, you know, I bet you they did. So I think that those Miocene apes that are called the long-armed apes, excuse me, the short-armed apes, rather, the short-armed apes, I think they walked upright.
Mm-hmm.
I think they just looked at their physiology and said, wait a minute, I'll feel better walking upright than I would squatted down, dragging my hands along the ground like I'm supposed to. Science says I was walking.
Yeah.
So now we have a whole body of creatures right there in the fossil record, in history, the Miocene short-armed apes that qualify, in my opinion, as perfect precursors for today's upright walking hominoids seen around the world on a very regular basis. If you accept all that I'm saying, it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense.
Mm.
And so, but it also, if you accept that, it makes perfect sense that we have both living quadrupedal apes, the four kinds, or six if you want to parse chimps and gorillas, that we have, and then you have the upright walking hominoids around the world. That covers the base of fossilized primates and living primates that we have in the world today. So where does that leave humans? It leaves us off the flowchart of natural life on Earth. And when science takes a look at that, what's the only thing they can do? They have to put that aside, and they can't talk about it openly. They know it, I know it, and now you know it. And everybody listening to this show now knows it. But you can't get them to talk about it openly, and you can't get them to admit it, because it says, it screams, it doesn't just say, it just screams, humans did not evolve on Earth. We don't have a place here in the natural flow of life on Earth, and science is not allowed to make a statement like that.
Why do you think?
So they can't.
Why do you think that this is so, you know, dangerous, as it were, for them? You know.
Why do I think that?
I mean, the resistance
because,
is so.
Because as soon as you make that allowance that humans didn't evolve here, are not a natural part of planet Earth. Where did we come from? And then that means you have to open up the question of alien and UFO reality, which is something that, that science doesn't want to deal with, government obviously doesn't want to deal with, and religion doesn't want to deal with. Nobody in power, nobody at the top of the power pyramids of this planet right now in this time wants to deal with that issue. Now, they have to deal with it on a daily basis. I mean, people see hominoids every day. People see UFOs every day. People are abducted by aliens every day. And so those stories are out there. But because of the combined power of that triumvirate of government and religion and science, because of their combined weight, their throw weight, when they put it against something they don't like or they don't want, they control the media. They control all the sources of output of information except the Internet. And so here we are, you and I, talking about this hidden information. Again, not forbidden, just hidden, bringing it out to whatever size audience you have. And when enough people do enough of this work that I'm doing now, that you're doing now, there will come a tipping point where enough of us will know the truth to force the issue. Something will happen. A hominoid will be killed and put in front of the world in a way that it can't be denied. You know, there was one killed back in 1968, the Minnesota Iceman, and went on display here in the States. And I was lucky enough to see it when I was a young man. No question that was a hominoid that had been killed. The wrong man killed it. Fred Hansen was just the wrong man. He was a sideshow carnival type hustler guy, and all he saw was dollar signs. He wanted to make money off of it, and that's what he did. But if it had been the right kind of person who would have turned it over to science in a way that science couldn't hide it, then we would. A hominoid reality would have been with us since 1967, ironically, the same year that the Patterson film, the famous Roger Patterson film, of the hominoid walking along the riverbank. Those two events happened incredibly the same year. But it just didn't go right. But one day it will. One day it will, and we'll have the proof, and it'll be undeniable, just like we think the Star Child skull is going to bring proof to the world that UFO and aliens are real, and in a way that's just undeniable. So it's coming. It will all come, and reality as we know it and understand it at this moment, as you and I talk, will change, and it will change wholesale and change forever, and everyone will just adapt to that new reality and continue on with their lives.
Yeah, and the sooner the better, if you ask me.
Well, sooner the better for me, too. I'd certainly like to see it in my lifetime, but, you know, we have to wait. There's obviously some kind of schedule that the world moves on that I'm not privy to, and I just try to keep doing my part and keep my shoulder to my particular wheel and keep pushing on it in the hope that other people are, you know, pushing their wheels, and together in a combined way, something will happen that will trigger a big event that will shift everything. And just like you, I hope to be around and hope it's sooner rather than later.
So this still then, we end up here with a big question mark, as it were, you know, where do you humans come from? And I would like to kind of get into that a little bit now, and I guess that this connects with what you refer to as the intervention theory, right?
Right. Well, where humans do come from, in my opinion, is that we were genetically engineered to be here. Now, you can argue about who did the engineering, but there's no doubt, if you look at our genes and our chromosomes, there's no doubt that we were and are engineered, and that we were built to a design. We were built for a purpose, a specific purpose. Whatever that purpose is, it is open to debate. I mean, people can argue about that. What they can't argue about is that we are genetically engineered, and not just us, on this planet. All of the so-called domesticated plants and animals, all of them have been genetically engineered. It's clear in their genes and chromosomes as well. Somebody came here, some group of beings came here and decided to reconstruct the pattern of life on Earth to suit apparently themselves, because they created animals, and they created plants, and they created humans. Now, I, for lack of a better option at this time, I go with the theory most promulgated by Zechariah Sitchin, that it was a group of aliens called the Anunnaki that live on a planet called Nibiru that's in our solar system. Now, a lot of people argue with that, but I feel like that Sitchin's work is, because it's based on the writings of the ancient Sumerians, at least it's built on writings. It's created around writing, things we can, you know, look at and discuss, and things that are, you know, that are strong in the evidence that they put forth. Again, it could all, you know, that whole thing about that Sitchin puts forth about the Anunnaki and could all be wrong. But what can't be wrong is that human beings and domesticated plants and animals are genetically engineered. Now, let's talk about some of the evidence for that. And it starts right away with chromosomes. All right, now, we supposedly evolve, according to science, we evolve from primates, just basic higher primates, from chimps. We're told that we share a common ancestor, a common genetic ancestor with chimps. Now, why? Well, because our DNA, our chromosomal package and our DNA, is only about 3% total different from a chimp. So that's an awful lot of congruence in our DNA package. So it's easy to make the connection and say, well, you know, 3%, that's awful close. It's very likely, it looks likely based on that, that we evolved from a common ancestor that we once had with chimps. Except when you look at the fact that they, all other higher primates, chimps, gorillas, all the higher primates, have 48 chromosomes. Hmm. Now, 48 chromosomes in your chromosomal package means that 24 comes from your mother and 24 comes from your father. When you are conceived, the two of them come together to create you, and you take some from mom, some from dad, and you create your own package that you're going to pass on to your offspring, in which you will deposit 24, and your mate will deposit her 24, or his 24, and you go from there. Mm. But the whole package from your mother and your father is in you. All 48 chromosomes are in you, in all your cells. Mm. There it sits.
Right.
Well, with human beings, that's different, and it's substantially different. We have 46. 46.
Mm-hmm.
23 from mom, 23 from dad. Well, you have to ask yourself, what happened to two whole chromosomes?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're talking about, in a human genome and in a primate genome, we're talking about 3 billion, with a B, 3 billion base pairs, which are the fundamental units, and about, with humans, about 25 or so thousand genes.
Mm-hmm.
They're still trying to get an exact number. But let's just call it 25,000 as a round number. So you got 3 billion base pairs arranged in about 25,000 genes collected into 46 chromosomes.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Now, with that in mind, how do you lose two whole chromosomes?
Mm-hmm.
That's an awful lot, awful, awful, awful lot of genetic material.
Mm-hmm.
How can you lose that and still be a primate, much less be an advanced, highly superior, much more intelligent primate? How you would think, if we're so much better than chimps, you would think that we would have 50 chromosomes, they have 48, we'd have 50 minimum, 52, 54, 56 minimum, to give us all the extra firepower that we've been given relative to them. But no, we lost two. We lost two and still came out with the way we are.
Yeah.
And we still came out with 3% difference from them.
Mm.
How can that be? Two chromosomes is a lot more than 3% difference, is it not?
Yeah.
It is. It's a lot more. So what happened? How does science explain this? They don't. They don't say anything about it. They just let it fly under the radar because most people don't have enough awareness or understanding to even ask the question, what happened? How could this be?
Yeah.
Well, the answer is simple. Again, hidden, but very simple. The two chromosomes that are missing are not really missing. They're not really missing.
All right.
Well, guess what? In the second and third chromosome of a primate, if you were to lay a chimp's chromosomes down beside us, and there would be a second one, and there would be a third one, and then a fourth one, and a fifth one, and right on up to 24.
Mm.
If you lay ours down, our 23 down, and you look at our second one, it is a perfect combination of the primate's second and third chromosome, which in primates are totally separate and function separately. But in human beings, guess what? They have been fused together, end to end.
Right.
Fused together, end to end, perfectly, seamlessly, so that they function, so that they still function, but they just take up one place, where they used to take up two places in the process of mitosis. Now, what does that mean? It means that somebody needed us to have 46 chromosomes so they could mate with us. And they were making us. They needed us to have 46 chromosomes, so they took the creatures of Earth that they were using as a model, and they adjusted it in a genetics lab, so that it would work to suit their purposes, to suit their needs. And so we were created, as it says in the Bible, and is written on stone in the Sumerian tablets. we shall create the Adamu in our own image after our own likeness. And this is what the Anunnaki supposedly said, and they did that. That is why we look so very different from primates. We're not primates. We're them. We have a little bit of primate in us, even though you have that at only 3% difference with chimps. But you're talking about 90 million, approximately, 90 million base pairs. That's a lot of base pairs. But what it also says is that life out there is pretty much ubiquitous as it is on the Earth. It's all built around the same base pairs, the same genes, the same chromosome type arrangements. And it's probably an explanation for why so much of our genetic package is junk, like as much as 96% of what we carry and what our cells keep maintaining is junk. Isn't junk. It's there for a reason. It's just science doesn't understand or know what the reason is. But it's probably part and parcel of allowing tremendous flexibility in the altering of us by whoever does the altering. Not just us, again, of other creatures out there, of all life out there. I don't believe, after a lot of study, I don't believe there is any evolution at all on the macro level. None at all. Meaning from species to species to species to species. I do think there is microevolution within species. Darwin, you know, clearly showed that with his finches, with the tortoises. And, you know, you can see it with dogs and cats and everything else. There is variation within limits.
But they don't.
But there's no transformation from one thing into another thing.
I see. That's fascinating. So this is so the in order for procreation to occur, it has to do with the chromosomes and the number of chromosomes. So the alleged interferers, as it were probably of the same amount of chromosomes as we were changed to then, 46, I guess.
Exactly. That's what I think. Yeah.
Wow. Fascinating. I mean, there's so many roads here to take. I mean, who were these guys, and you know, how do you have a theory even how far back this might have occurred?
Well, yes, in my book Everything You Know Is Wrong, which, by the way, if people are interested in it at this point, they'll have to buy a used version, because the new version, the updated version, is not going to be available until October. Sometime. So I'm sorry for that, but I in that book, in part four, I give kind of a condensed version of the explanation for it, the full, much more detailed explanation that's given by Zechariah Sitchin in his famous book, The 12th Planet. So if anybody wants to read the basic text that gives this information about the Anunnaki and Nibiru and what the tablets, what the Sumerian tablets say about these things, get a book called The 12th Planet by Zechariah Sitchin, which is much, much detail given, or you get my book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, and in part four of it, I give the condensed version as part of what I talk about in the book. But in any event, the time frame, well, just for one example, in the tablets, which were written or date back to around 5,000 years ago, 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 years ago, in that range. They say that the Adamu, us, the human beings, well, I mean, where do you think the name Adam comes from in the Bible?
A lot
of it is taken, a lot of the Old Testament, and particularly Genesis, is taken from the earlier tablets that were from, you know, written by the Sumerians, and it came down, quote, written in stone. I mean, you know, the hallmark of truth in the old days was it's written in stone. Well, people didn't actually write in stone. They didn't carve it out like we do, you know, carve out words on tombstones with marble. They didn't do that. They wrote it in stone, but they the way they did that was they wrote it on soft clay at first. They would take clay and then they'd write it, and then they'd put that in a kiln, and they'd bake it and turn it into stone.
Mm.
And then it would, so those they are stone tablets now.
That's right.
And so one of the things that they say is that they created us. They created the Atamu about approximately 200,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, when that was first talked about, Sitchin wrote his book in 1976, and people, you know, critics would just say, oh, please, mm-hmm. utterly, utterly ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's clear that human beings have evolved for millions of years, right?
Mm-hmm.
200,000 years? That's ridiculous. No mm-hmm. way. Then comes 1986, 10 years later, and they begin to open up mitochondrial DNA, human mitochondrial DNA, which
mm-hmm.
comes from mothers, and they made the incredible discovery at the time. You may remember, if you're old enough, the amount of incredible publicity about this. They found out that, indeed, human beings, our gene package, looks as if it extends back in time no further than about 200,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, and you can see the book is out, it's called, The Seven Daughters of Eve.
Mm-hmm.
It seems as if all human beings track down or can trace back genetically themselves to one of seven different original groups.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Guess what else? The Sumerians wrote that there was finally, after, as they were creating us, there was finally seven successes between seven females and seven males.
Hmm.
That's how it all started.
Wow, really?
Now,
that's fascinating.
What are the odds on this?
Mm.
What are the odds on this? This is incredible.
Yeah.
And is this widely known? Is this talked about? No, mm-hmm. it's not. Because of, again, what it means to science and religion and government, it's just things they are not ready to deal with until it gets absolutely crammed down their throats and they don't have any choice, and then they will deal with
mm.
it. But until then, they're going to just pretend that it doesn't exist, and even though it does.
Mm. Wow, and you also, I mean, beyond human beings then being manipulated or being brought forward, as it were, you also mentioned the genetic experimentation of plants and other species on this planet. I mean,
animals, sure. Mm-hmm. Domesticated plants and animals. Well, it's clear they didn't develop here naturally. You can trace them back. I go into the details of it in, again, Everything You Know Is Wrong with plants, and you have it's a little harder to explain in terms that people can understand, because you have to talk about genetics, you have to talk about multiple chromosomes,
mm-hmm.
a number of issues. But just for example, we're told that for say grains and grasses, right?
Mm-hmm.
The grains and grasses of old that spawned that are the progenitors of modern day seeds that we use, like oats and wheat and barley and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They all work for us now. They're fine. We can plant them. We can harvest them and all that. We are told, because all of them, all of these plants and animals, seem to come out of the blue in a period between about 10,000 years ago and about 5,000 years ago.
Hmm.
There have been no new ones since, but somehow these Stone Age farmers and animal husbandry people could do this, could create these creatures.
Hmm.
And they expect us to believe this, that somehow somebody looked at a grass seed that's the size of a pepper flake and somehow got the idea that, well, if we pull out the biggest ones of these and plant them and then pick out the biggest ones that produces and plant them and pull out the biggest ones that produces, over time, over thousands of years, we're going to get a product that will be big enough for us to see easily, to handle with our hands easily, and that somehow along the way the biochemistry is going to be changed such that the product will be something that we can eat and digest and our bodies can use.
Because
right now, while we're starting this project, it's just grass, and our bodies can't use them, and, and it's grass that animals eat.
Mm-hmm.
But if we undertake this process of slowly evolving these grass seeds, it's going to turn into a grain that we can use and that our bodies can assimilate.
Mm-hmm.
And we're expected to believe, that somehow this was pulled off by these people. Now, you know, in the same way that religion requires and turns to miracles to explain, you know, the loaves and fishes and walking on the water and all the miracles that you read about in the Bible, they're no different than the scientific miracles that we are expected to believe.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those scientific miracles. It just happened. Take it on faith, because we have these things now. We don't allow any outside intervention. So the only people that could have done it were these Stone Age people from 10,000 to 5,000 years ago. So we can't imagine how, but they did it somehow, because we can't allow anything else to be considered as a possible source of these products. And so there you go.
Hmm.
People just go about in a daze believing this garbage.
Sure.
That it could have happened when it absolutely could not have happened. These things had to be genetically engineered in a lab. The people who came had to look at the grasses and grains that were here and say, what can we turn this stuff into?
Hmm.
And they would do it, because you can track back to the origin seeds or plants or whatever of just about everything. Now, some you can't. Some, there are no, like bananas, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Just, they come out of nowhere. But they're incredibly good, wholesome foods. And you have some things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing goes with animals, domesticated animals. Like, for example, the cheetah.
Mm-hmm.
The cheetah is the first, one of the very, very first, one of the earliest that's in every early civilization that we have. It's with the Sumerians, with the Egyptians, Greeks, Romans. Everybody has cheetahs. They go way back, right?
Mm.
But guess what about cheetahs? They are all virtually clones. When they started doing analysis of them, they found out that no matter where they are in the world, and they come from Asia and they come from Africa, they are basically genetically, you could skin one, pretty much skin a cheetah from Asia and skin one from Africa and swap their skins and stitch them back together, and they'd heal up and be okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's
really
how close they all are genetically.
All
but
right.
Guess what else? A cheetah is a genetic combination of a dog and a cat.
Really?
It has a dog's feet. It has the heavy pads, hard pads of a dog's feet. Because why? It runs so fast, and it makes such sharp turns. If it had soft feet, it would just slip.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't do what it does. It had to have dog feet, so it's got dog feet. It doesn't have retractable claws like cats have.
Okay.
It's susceptible. Cheetahs are susceptible to diseases that are specific to both cats and dogs.
Hmm.
Now, most people are not aware of this at all. But still, a cheetah is a very distinct and unusual animal designed to do one thing, and that's hunt.
Hmm.
The early people, the Anunnaki, you can just see them sitting around in the lab one day saying, you know, we need to make us something that'll get out there and hunt for us.
Hmm.
You know, let's make something faster than anything else on the savannas.
Hmm.
And that's what the cheetah is, way faster.
Wow.
And then they had the design problems to work out with the feet and the head. The head's very streamlined, and if you look at a cheetah running, it's got a balance mechanism so that its head stays straight as its body's doing. If you ever see slow motion films of cheetahs running to hunt, man, their bodies are flying all over the place, and those heads are like they're on gimbals. The head just stays steady; it doesn't lose track of what it's looking at. Cheetahs are fascinating animals. They really, really are, because they are genetically engineered to be what they are.
Wow. So also in regards to, you know, the seeds that we talked about earlier and some of the, you know, the wheat and other that we use now and harvest, of course, have we been helped here then? This is like an experimentation going on here?
Well, at first, if you go by what the Sumerians wrote, we were created simply to be a slave force for the people who were here.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't that many of them. They were here, and they were living here, and they had set up a permanent, quasi-permanent base here. But they needed work done, and they needed hands and brains to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want to do it. So they created a slave and a servant, which is what we human beings were. We were created to be a slave and a servant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they had to give that in order for them to be able to mate with us and use us for recreation as well. They needed to make us a lot like them physically, which we are.
Mm-hmm.
And that one of the things they had to do was give us their brain. Now, their brain obviously is fairly supercharged relative to ours,
mm-hmm.
because of, you know, who they are and what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're making a slave and a servant, you don't want it to be nearly as smart as you are.
True, bright, yeah, that's right.
So what you have to do is you have to limit the access of the slave and the servant to the whole brain, and you only give them a small part of the brain to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's heard that we only use about 10% of what we have, but there's a lot of argument about that because it looks like we use all portions of our brain at various times.
Mm-hmm. But not at the same time.
I'm a firm believer that we don't use all that's in our heads, because I believe what are called savants, what used to be called idiot savants and what are now called savants, but savants show clearly, there's over 100 of these people that have been recorded and followed. I believe that these people show clearly that in the damage to the fully functional, normal part of their brain, there is somehow a tear in the partition that is in my head and your head and the heads of normal people. There's a tear in that partition that allows a savant to see into the forbidden part of the brain, to access and utilize the forbidden part of the Anunnaki brain. And that's why they have these phenomenal talents like Rain Man. We've all seen what savants can do.
Mm-hmm.
And the feats that they can accomplish are so incredibly beyond what normal humans can do, that if that part is available to them, if that part of their brain is available to them, that part of the brain would be available to us if we knew how to drop the partition that the Anunnaki put in our heads so that we would be smart enough to follow instructions and do what they told us to do, but we would never be smart enough to get together and gang up on them and cause them any trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's how we were created, to be strong but not too strong and smart but not too smart, so we would never be create a real problem for them while they were here and while they were our lords and masters.
Wow. And you know, I can't resist to ask the question, considering what you said about the you know, the similarity then potentially between humans and the Anunnaki. I mean, could there be some still around today? What's going on there?
Well, there could, but one of the things that they say in the writings is that the Anunnaki have a kind of a glow about themselves, a kind of a physical aura that you could see, that you knew immediately when you were in the presence of a god. And that's what they were called, the gods, but with a small g, rather than God as we, you know, where did the term God come from? It comes from the Adamu called the Anunnaki their gods. That was, you know, Lord and Master, that was the term God with a small g. So they knew instantly when they were looking at one because they had like a glow around them that they can see. And I would argue that when Anunnaki were seen later in time, that's where the thing about halos came from, angels of the Lord or angels or whatever.
Yeah.
The people who saw them later were looking at Anunnaki and they were saying they had this glow around their head.
Sure, you know, sure.
And that's what they were. So I think they couldn't walk around in everyday society necessarily right now because we'd see the glow if it was the real, true 100% Anunnaki. But
wow.
Can hybrids be out there? I suppose they can. I don't really know. It's just speculation on my part. Mm-hmm. I do not know.
Yeah, me neither. And this, to me at least, connects very much with the story, of course, of the Nephilim, the biblical story, which sometimes are referred to as the shining ones, you know.
Right, exactly.
So it's right there, and it seems to be kind of crossing all kinds of different cultures and mythologies about these beings, the gods, as you say, that were down here.
Yeah,
and
exactly. I think there's no doubt that they were here, that they did do what the Sumerians say they did, and they did it in other cultures as well. I think they are the source of all the major cultures, the culture of India, the culture of the cultures of the Americas. All of the early cultures, I think, were created and governed and ruled by shining ones, by Kukulkan and, mm-hmm. in the Americas and just all of them. And when they finally left, as they seem to have done,
mm-hmm.
They left. They just turned the keys to the store over to us, or you might say they turned the keys to the asylum over to the inmates. I don't, however you want to put it,
yeah.
But that's what seems to have happened.
Huh, fascinating. And we're beginning to run out time here for this first segment. But I would love to continue here talking about, of course, the Starchild skull, and if there is a connection, what you have found between these two areas, as it were. And I would love to dive into all of this because it's fascinating, and there's so much more information here. But before
certainly the Starchild skull is worth hearing about because that is history in the making.
Definitely, and the potential of that, there is some evidence for genetic experimentation there also, of course, and lots of that stuff. But before we end off this segment, you did mention one of your books that they were currently out of print, Everything You Know Is Wrong, Origins of Life and Humans, but you also have a new one out there. Tell people about your new book and when your first book will be out again, and of course how people can get them also.
Well, the new book that is out and available now, and it will be available, I think, in Sweden as well, through your bookstores, local bookstores, and Amazon. Although it won't be in Swedish, it'll be in English,
mm-hmm.
Unfortunately. But maybe we'll get it translated in the not too distant future, maybe next year sometime. It's called The Starchild Skull. The Starchild Skull. Genetic, and the subtitle is Genetic Enigma or Human Alien Hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
And that is available now through Bell Labs. If you want to get a hardback, a signed, personally signed by me hardback, you can get it through Bell Labs Books. That is www.bell, then the word LAP, and then books, BOOKS. So it's BELL. LAPBOOKS, BellLapBooks.com, and if you want to get a paperback, you can all sign. You can also get that as well. It's less expensive, and if you want to order it there from Amazon or any of your bookstores there, you can do that probably in the next week or so. The paperback is just now becoming available. To be printed overseas in a factory in London.
Mm.
So we're trying to make it available as widely as we can in Europe, and it, like I said, it should be next week if everything goes right.
Yeah.
So it's pretty exciting for us, and it'll be easy for people to pick it up that way. However, if, again, you want the hardback, you can go through Bell Labs Books, and we'll send one to you. You do have to pay, though, for international shipping, which is like $11.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So you got to consider the cost of it, but it's a very good book. And the hardback, of course, has the color pictures that the paperback does not.
Mm.
The hardback has 40 color photos in it that the paperback will not have. But those same color pictures are available on the website, www.starchildproject.com. Starchild, StarChildProject, StarchildProject.com. So you can see the pictures there if you get the the paperback, the photos are in black and white. I mean, you see them clearly in black and white, but there's really nothing quite like color for the ones that are reproduced in color in the hardback.
That's right. And also check out, of course, Lloyd Pye. That's LLOYD and PYE, LloydPye.com. And we will continue now in the next segment for our subscribers. But for this segment, Lloyd, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning into the program. We will continue speaking with Lloyd for our subscribers now. And we are going to talk about the fascinating Starchild skull. And we'll get deeper into the question if this is evidence for a human-alien hybrid. Fascinating material coming up for our subscribers. Thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren behind the controls. This is Henrik Palmgren, and we will be back on Sunday with our regular guest Alan Watt. Until then, take good care. We'll talk soon. Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll, that is so he said. Then the loud sound, it seemed to fade, came back like a slow voice on a